You then went on to the endurance and eventually wound up at Deception.
Yes.
And this was what year was this? This was
1968.
Right, so it was a year after the first significant eruption.
The first significant eruption was, to my best of my knowledge, November of the previous year, yes.
Were you expecting another eruption?
No. I don't think anybody expected another eruption. Obviously thought that was blown. It's blown, it's thrown up new islands and bits and pieces and changed the coastline here, there and everywhere. That'll probably be it.
What was the base like when you got there?
It's fine. Yes, absolutely fine. Just as if somebody had walked out a week before. It was fine.
So your job was to wind it up effectively, was it?
Well, to close it properly. Make sure the windows are covered and stuff's put away and stores are properly listed and make sure the hangar's shut up and all bits. You can't not just walk out the door, because it's rather a long way north, and all sorts of strange ships would come calling. You didn't know what was going to happen to your base if it wasn't obviously secured and wanted. It became a bit more of a problem in later years. Get Russian trawlers and things down there. I think they put people ashore with a bottle of vodka and said, this is your day off, go and enjoy yourself. And then they'd go to a whaling station somewhere and smash it to bits. Smash it to bits. That could have happened at Deception. Nature did it for us.
Hmm. We'll come to that in a minute.
Yes.
The air unit was trying out a new otter, is that right? What was happening there?
I think that was the first year of the twin otter, and that staged through Deception to go to Adelaide. And they had got a single otter, a piston otter, off the Norwegians. Rumour has it it spent a year at the bottom of a lake somewhere. But there we are. It came to us and it came on... I don't know how it came now. I think it might have come on Biscoe. And it was brought ashore on rafts and things and pushed up the beach and taken to the hangar and reassembled. It wouldn't have had any wings or tail or bits and pieces on it, and they had to reassemble it all, check it all out and flight test it. That was the job of two or three of the air mechanics.
Where were they doing the testing flights to and from?
Oh, just round the local islands. I did have a flight in it once. It was a marvellous old beast. Beautiful old aeroplane. I remember flying across King George Island and then back to Deception. Anyway, that went off south and started work down out of Adelaide. And, of course, the Twin Otter at that time, when it first went through, had to get to Adelaide reasonably quickly to fly on down to Fossil Bluff at some stage, where there were the crew of the Pilatus Porter, which had crunched itself badly the previous autumn, the end of season the previous year, and they were force-wintered at Fossil Bluff. And they obviously had enough supplies and they got on. Mm. Had enough to eat. There's always enough to eat at these places. And the Twin Otter was going to go down and pick them all up and come back and evacuate them. But the Twin Otter took off, excess of zeal, I think. I don't think I'm traducing anybody by saying there was an excess of zeal. And they took off into cloud to go down to the bluff. And they got navigation wrong or whatever. Probably had no decent weather forecast, and I think the wind drifted them miles off course. They went down, missed the bluff, and then came back up and missed Adelaide. And effectively, they went right across the peninsula and landed on the Larsen Ice Shelf on the east coast. In fact, one of the chaps on the one of the Amex I did know reasonably well swore that he saw rocks go by because they were flying in cloud the whole time. And they got to such a point where they just said, "We're going to set it up to land, and that's it. And where we land, we land." And they landed on the Larsen Ice Shelf. But that chap came back, and from when I knew him, he looked like a ghost. He looked like a ghost. Yeah. I think that affected him quite badly.
You mean later on? He was still.
By the time they'd flown these people out to Deception.
Right.
They were. The aircraft on the east coast was rescued by Endurance with its helicopters ferrying fuel, staging fuel across the peninsula to refuel them so they could fly back to Adelaide.
But the pilot who'd made the forced landing was psychologically damaged.
No, not the pilot. One of his mechanics.
I beg your pardon.
No. Better be careful what I say.
No. All
right. But the pilot seemed, full of beans and, jolly hockey sticks, old chaps, wizard prang and all that. But his mechanic was ashen.
Talking about ash, what was the first indication that the volcanic activity at Deception was not over as you'd imagined?
Previous month, shall we say, there was increasing frequency of tremors. It'd be one every 5 days or one a week or something, and then it went to 5 days and 4 days, and gradually the frequency increased to such an extent that it was obvious that something was going to happen.
And you were there at the time?
We were there at the time, yes. And the Argentines had reoccupied their base across on the other side of the island. It's a ring crater, and all the bases were on the inside of the ring. And they were sort of, about 8 miles away up the other coast. But about 3 days before it erupted, they sailed out of the island, and they said, "Bye bye, take care, we're going home. We do not like the tremolos."
I can see their point.
I can see their point. Yes, but they were sensible.
Why was it that the Argentinians evacuated, but the British didn't?
I don't think we hadn't finished what we were doing. I don't think we had ships particularly near at the time. And, nobody knew what was going to happen. And, I guess I'd hang on a few more, couple of weeks or something. But early one morning it went.
Come on, can you elaborate on the phrase, "it went"?
In the night, there were some quite serious tremors. There was a huge bang up the hill, a bang and a thump, and it sounded like somebody had ejected a boulder the size of a house. But the tremors were so bad that all the fire extinguishers crashed off the wall. The place was shaking, and all the water tanks in the old Whalers building, they were sloshing backwards and forwards as if... I think they did spill over, but they were... All the water tanks in the roof were sloshing backwards and forwards, and things were falling over. So
you felt the ground moving under your feet, did you?
Oh, yeah. Yes. But then it's not the movement, but it's the noise that goes with it. It's like having an underground train 6 feet under your feet. It's like an underground train going... you can tell the direction that it's going. There's this tremendous noise travelling through the ground. A bit disconcerting, really.
What was the first reaction?
Send radio messages.
You were in the base at the time?
Oh, yes, we were in the base. I think there was a last minute attempt to just nip up and bang some closure, window closure sheets onto the hanger, which we started to do. But one of the tremors came through while we were doing that at the hangar, and I swear the building leaned towards us and then went back again. It did lean towards us. We can't have done anything else. Tremendous. Anyway, said, you know, let's stop this. Silly doing this. Go back to the base and radio. And I think an arrangement was agreed with one of the ships that we would make our way to South Point, which was outside the island, on the outside of the island, where we could be picked up relatively easily by ship. And we never got there. You know, by the time we were making our way up the inside of the crater to go over the top, and it blew. It blew while we were out in the open.
Can you just describe what you've spot happened?
It wasn't particularly a lot of noise, but, you know, the thing changed from just sort of shaking about to sending this huge column of black straight up in the sky. Just enormous. It looked about 2 miles away, the activity. It's probably a little bit closer, but just a huge column of black going straight up in the sky and went into the cloud. And that was it. We could see it was erupting, and that was the black ash coming out.
So it was coming out from the part of the volcano that was the rim. It wasn't coming out of the water.
Oh, no, it was coming out of a point high up on the inner rim. Volcanologists went along there later to have a look, and they said a large crack had opened up, several metres wide, tens of metres perhaps, had opened and relieved the pressure. And they said it was all full of glowing stuff in the bottom and all the rest of it, which probably natural. But the previous eruption, you see, had destroyed the Chilean base, which was quite close to us. It actually destroyed it, knocked the place down and just flattened everything.
So you were away from the base when this big eruption took place, and you decided to return?
Yeah, go back to base. There's no point in...
And when you got there?
When I got there, the disaster. I mean, the place had been virtually destroyed. Didn't destroy the building, it just knocked a very large hole through the old whaler's hut. And previous to that, we decided, had we been on base and it had erupted, the place with the most strength in it was the old whaler's building, because it had solid 4-inch thick wooden walls. Stand under the door frames in there, and we'd have been right where that hole went through the building.
So you had a very lucky escape.
I think we had a very lucky escape, yeah. It was a huge hole. The roof was still intact, but there was two halves of a building and with a hole in the middle. It smashed a...
The lava had gone straight through.
Well, it wasn't lava, it was something called lahar, which is a mixture of ice blocks, water, ash and rock, a whole lot. A bit like the Japanese tsunami. You know, you see all this stuff being thrown about. The same thing with natural materials. It'd come down the hillside and wallop straight through. Mm. It swept away a farm tractor, which was parked outside. That's 100 yards down the... down the slope now, with just a steering wheel sticking out the ground.
Sounds a bit more like Abba Van than...
Yes, yeah, Fukushima. Very much. Yeah, very much that, yeah.
So when you go back to the base and you saw what had happened, what were your options then? Because...
Well, the base was then uninhabitable because we'd left the generators running. I believe the radio operator left the key screwed down so that, you know, anybody listening to the transmitter signal would be able to know if it went off that something had happened. Well, the all this mud and muck and rock had come down the passageway into the generator shed and just flowed straight through the generators. The generator that was running, that we'd left running, ruined. Totally ruined. The engine was still running. Good, faithful old Lister, still banging away. But electrically, it was just bare copper, the whole lot, gone. And the mud had flowed through into the plastic, modern, well, semi-modern plastic part of the building. So the most likely place to be picked up would be the hangar. There's the biggest building there, easily visible. So we went to the hangar and sort of camped out for a bit in the hangar workshop. I remember I found there was a big coil of big coarse rope there. I managed to, I sat down on it and went to sleep. Yeah, obviously walking about and probably a bit traumatised at that time. But we had, we guessed that somebody would come in a helicopter. Just, yeah, there was a Chilean ship reasonably near, we understood. The same ship that had done the rescue of the previous people from the previous eruption. So we went outside and opened up two drums of AVTA, took the tops off and stood them in line with the hangar about 100 yards away and lit them just as beacons to say, you know, two drums on fire, this is where we are. And they burned for a long, amazing length of time.
Sorry?
They burned for an amazing length of time.
Yeah. Well, how long did they have to wait to be rescued?
I can't honestly remember. Probably about 5 hours, five, 6 hours.
So amidst all this ash and dust, an Italian helicopter appeared?
No, it was a Chilean.
Chilean helicopter?
Yeah, Chilean. Chilean helicopter appeared. The ship was the Piloto Pardo. Helicopter appeared through the narrows, through the bellows, they called it. There was still quite lots of ash in the air, but it stopped. It stopped raining chunks, if you like. There was a lot of fine ash in the air, and the helicopter came in, and we all squeezed on board, and off we went.
How did it cope with the ash?
Oh, the pilot was flying sideways.
How do you mean?
Well, the front of his bubble was just black. At the end, you know, he flew flying sideways and landed
looking
sideways.
Out the door.
Well, yes, if you like, not looking through them. It was transparent all the way around, looking sideways. As soon as he landed, they threw buckets of water over the front so he could see. Amazing. We were so squashed in there, I had to hold the door shut. You know, we were all way overloaded, I think. I had to hold the door shut. He couldn't shut the door. Very grateful to them. They treated us very well.
He got an award, didn't he?
Yes, he did. I think he got a Distinguished Flying Medal. I think so.
Have you ever been back to Deception since?
Yes, yes. At least once, probably twice. Yeah. Amazed.
What's your feelings going back?
Oh, I don't mind. Go and look at it and think, gosh, yeah, what power of that stuff. Because it swept through the whaling station, the old whaling station that was there. It swept through that and just took machinery and tanks and so all sorts of stuff straight out into the bay.
So there was more destruction after you'd been evacuated?
Oh, no, I think this was...
All at the same time?
All at the same time,
yeah.
I think the main flow had gone through the whaling station. It's quite an, obviously derelict at the time, but quite a large industrial setup in its time, and it just wrecked it, completely wrecked it. And I think the base was on a side stream, luckily.
Did you at any time think that was it, that your lives may not last much longer?
No, I don't think so, no. I think we realised that it wasn't I don't think we knew too much about volcanoes. not as much as I know now, but I think we realised by the nature of it, it was going to be not necessarily lethal.
Right.
You know, if you'd seen the like Montserrat, where the boiling clouds of incandescent ash coming down, I think if we'd seen that, we'd have been extremely worried. It wasn't. It was pellets of black ash going and coming up. They came down coated in frost, coated in ice. They'd been up so high through the clouds and back down again that they had frost all over them.
Did I read somewhere that you were running around with sheets of corrugated iron over your head?
Yes, yeah. There was an Irish lad, John O'Toole, and it was his idea. Pretty good thinking on his part. You know, we were halfway up this slope and there were some old whalers' huts. I think they used to store the gunpowder and things way away from the station. And he said, oh, you know, corrugated iron, let's get it, and ripped it off and put it over our heads. Great idea. A Wrigley tin umbrella.
After your evacuation from Deception, you wound up at Adelaide Island.
Yes.
Okay. And what were you doing there?
I was engaged as a tractor mechanic. There was only two tractors on base.
It was a fairly simple job then, was it?
Not bad at all. But they were quite vital because they took all the aircraft fuel up to the airstrip, about a mile away, up the slope. And they were needed for that.
There were two muskegs, is that?
Two muskegs, right, yes. Yeah.
And were they in good condition?
Yeah, they were fair, yes. Yeah, I took them both to bits in the winter. And
they weren't new, were they?
Oh, no, I suspect they might have been even ex-Halley or God knows where from. Yeah, they might have been ex-Halley.
But they were reliable?
They were very good, yes. I still like old muskegs, but they were good. Yeah.
Were there any special tricks you had to employ to keep them in good condition or to coax them? Rather like nursing a baby.
Not necessarily. They took a bit of preheating in the depths of winter to get them started, but once you started them, they would go and wouldn't stop. They were meant for that sort of work. Mm. Meant for working amongst tree stumps and bogs in frozen Canada. And suited us fine.
When you got to Adelaide, somebody pointed out a chap called Big Al Smith to you.
Yeah, Big Al.
Which had implications, didn't it?
Yeah, I hadn't met Big Al then. I'm not sure if he was at conference. I don't think he was. I think he was doing his building planning and the rest of it. And, I don't think it was a conference. I'd never met him. I got a feeling I had no idea that he even existed, but, you know, I stepped ashore and somebody said, Big Al's on base. You know, I thought, oh, gosh, who is this Big Al?
Capone?
Who? I thought, oh, right, better watch my step then. Anyway, I went up to the base and Big Al was there. And he, big man, he, in those days he was even, you know, bigger than he is now. Immensely strong, he was a very strong man. But he was there in his bib and brace overalls with his sort of thumbs tucked in, giving it the usual way they do. But he was obviously in charge of the building. They were putting up a steel frame building to serve as a store and a Met office, and it was squeezed tight between other buildings, and no lifting aids whatsoever, but Al was lifting the steel into place and holding it while a little tiny light lad was running about on top of the steel poking the bolts in at the same time, and that's the way they built it.
So hang on, Al was rather like Hercules.
Holding the steel beams up,
and there's a man on top,
there's a little lad running about on top, popping the bolts in.
Right. You sound surprised that there was any work going on at all, any building work going on at all.
No.
Were you not expecting it?
Well, I didn't. I actually didn't know of it. I'm not sure that it was mentioned particularly at conference, and I hadn't picked it up. But yeah, this building was going on, but it was left for the base members to finish it off at the end of summer. I think some of our lads did the wiring and all that sort of stuff.
That was your first winter, wasn't it?
That was my first winter, yes.
And I'm wondering how the winter went.
It went very well, I think, yes. Yes, I mean, Adelaide isn't one of the finest places to winter.
Why is that?
Well, I didn't know any better. I quite enjoyed it. But it's quite a restricted base area. It's tucked amongst coastal rocks at the foot of an ice slope. The actual base buildings are quite tightly hemmed in by rocks. Very windy. Not much of a view at all. In fact, no view. Nothing like some of the other bases for amenity.
Were the tractors working through the winter?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, at least one was always working, yeah.
Tell me about how you passed the time of day then, when you weren't working in the dark winter. You had an entertainment officer.
Yes, that was the doctor, Terry Allen. He was the Ents officer. And we used to have fancy dress parties. All sorts of wonderful get-ups. There was Wild West and was probably some politically incorrect ones, which ended up with us blacking up and all sorts of things. Yeah, we had quite regular parties and do's.
Where did you get the fancy dress outfits from?
Made them. Made them essentially out of anything that was hanging about. They're quite ingenious. Yes, I don't think people brought costumes down with them. Not like they do today.
So we're looking at base curtains and...
Yes, curtains and cushions. The jacket you came down with was, sacrificed and cut up and made into something. Yes.
Did you enjoy wintering? Was it?
Oh yes, yeah.
Why was it such a good thing to have done?
I think because you become part of quite a tight knit community. You're totally reliant on each other to perform jobs, duties, all the rest of it. And yes, it worked. It worked. And there's nobody there that wasn't reliable. And the whole lot gelled.
Did you not mind the isolation of being cut off from the rest of the world?
No, not at all.
In fact, was that a bonus, perhaps?
Possibly, but... no, it never worried me at all.
I mean, you were being locked away from the rest of the world at quite an exciting time, weren't you, in the middle 60s?
I missed the moon landings, the first moon landing, which was a shame. Things like that you miss, but you're going to miss something.
Okay. So you were there then when the summer dawned again, you were still there. And you went off to Fossil Bluff yourself.
Yes, yeah, I had a couple of weeks at Fossil Bluff. Very enjoyable. Completely different.
And then came the transfer.
Yes.
To?
Went to Stonington.
Was that planned or was that a surprise?
Sometime in the middle of winter, they sent a signal down, London sent a signal down saying, anybody wish to transfer to anybody anywhere else, providing positions are available, etc., etc. And I think half the people on base transferred to Stonington.
It was seen as a more attractive deal, was it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Much more attractive place. It had a lot of history behind it. It was a travelling base. Whereas ours wasn't particularly. There are two dog teams at Adelaide, but they went off in the early spring and went across to Stonington and joined their programmes.
As a tractor mechanic or diesel mechanic, did he have much to do with the dogs?
I did at Stonington. A diesel mech is always nominated as pup man. So any pups that are born, they take a bit of looking after while they're young. He's nominated as pup man and he looks after them.
Was that just a sort of a local tradition?
I think it probably was, yeah. Mm. Yeah. They figure you've got lots of spare time, I think. Which is not entirely true, but... yes.
So how did you adapt to being a maternity nurse?
Oh, I liked it. I mean, they're little devils. Over the 2 years I was there, you know, I cared for 50 pups. That's a lot of buckets of milk and... You know, chopped up bits of seal to take them when they're small. Yeah. And in the winter too. You know. Mm. Used to walk out with a bucket of milk in 80 knots or something. And there'd be sheets of milk blowing everywhere.
It would freeze when it left the pail.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. 80 knots, of course, is sort of just the right sort of wind. You can start to lean on, you know, and let go. And you can just be supported by the wind. Got to be about 80 knots.
Did you get out and about much at Stonington, or were you still tied to base because of your...
I wasn't entirely tied to base. I used to go up in the summer when all the field people disappeared and they left two of us on base. Radio op and myself were left on base and we had to keep the place going, look after any pups, cook for ourselves... clean occasionally, perhaps. And when the aircraft visited, one of us had to go up to the airstrip and meet it, and goods on, goods off, people on, perhaps back to base. It took up just about every scrap of time. Yeah, it was quite busy.
One of the problems at Stonington at that time was the water supply, wasn't it?
Oh, it's awful, yeah.
Tell me about that.
Water supply was traditional, i.e. you cut snow blocks. It was fine in the winter, absolutely fine. Cut snow blocks and drifts outside the door. The only snag, of course, was that when the pups got big enough, you used to let them free. And the snow blocks used to contain all sorts of things, but nobody ever caught anything. Occasionally there'd be the dead penguin because he's in a big snow block, you don't know what's inside it. A slab of seal blubber that the dogs had left or something, or a piece of dead penguin. You know, you'd lift the lid of the water tank, look in, there'd be something circulating slightly in it. Fish it out and not tell anybody. But you wouldn't want to waste the water.
No.
It's so laborious to collect it. In the summer, the water was difficult. If it hadn't snowed recently and drifted enough to be able to cut blocks or slabs or whatever, you used to have to scour the beaches for reasonably decent clear ice that floated in on the tide. You need to do that quite a lot.
Was the ice not salty?
If it's clear, you can just about guarantee it's not salty. And very old sea ice loses its salt. It eventually becomes slightly salt, obviously, but not bad enough to stop you drinking it.
Boiled, I presume.
Oh, yeah, drinking water was boiled. The kitchen had its own separate drinking water tank. You boiled a kettle and then topped the tank up for drinking water. Although the bathroom water wasn't treated in the slightest. People used to clean their teeth with the cold water, which was, you know, obviously not that sterile.
What were the hygienic arrangements like in those days? I mean, were you able to have a shower at all?
Yes. Yes, Adelaide had a shower and Stonington and Sher, both consisting of a 5-gallon oil drum. And you'd hang it up on the wall. You'd fill it as much as possible, but it's impossible to lift a 5-gallon oil drum and hook it on a hook some way above your head. So you used to probably get about 4 gallons in it. And you could have a very satisfactory shower with 4 gallons of warm water. You know, you'd wet down and then soap all over and rest it, and then rinse it off, and that was fine.
What did you do with the water afterwards, though?
Oh, it was run to waste. And waste, it just meant outside the hut at that time.
And then froze?
And it froze, yes, but it used to disappear through the rocks. And, of course, it melted away in summer.
Yes.
It used to smell awful. But nobody, with the other smells around these places, you never noticed it at all. But you got your shower once every, depending on how many people are on base. You used to cycle through, and if there's 11 on base, you got a shower every 11 days. 17 on base, you got a shower every 17 days. And that was when you did your gash duties. You had a chance to do clothes washing, have a shower, and then you're on cook the next day.
What was the attitude of the Fids towards these new mechanical contraptions, the muskegs and the skidoos? Were they embracing them with open arms, or was there a rear guard action?
The muskegs were in a different class. You know, they were heavy-ish transport. You know, you'd pull 20 drums with them or something. They were there for a semi-industrial purpose, you know, taking fuel up to the airstrip, or drums around base, or, you know, pulling sledges of supplies and bits and pieces. I think the skidoos themselves were looked on askance by people in the field when I was there. But I think they probably realised that the time was fast approaching when they would have to be used. And they were at the very end of the era of serious use of dogs. And they had the art of travelling by dogs down to, you know, probably the peak of it. There was a couple of them that did 3,000 miles in a year with dogs. And obviously they couldn't travel in all that time. It was a bit in spring, a bit in autumn, but mostly in the summer.
You talked at the beginning about the reluctance you had towards the modernisation of the administration at Bass.
Yes.
Was there a similar kind of reluctance towards the modernisation of transportation in the Antarctic from some of the regulars there?
Probably, yes. I mean, down at base personnel level, you know, it was always, they've always been rude about mechanical transport. But I think it had eventually to come. Couldn't hold it off any longer.
When it was time to come away from the Antarctic, you actually came back again. You seem to specialise in first voyages. You were on the first voyage of the Bransfield.
Oh, yeah, it was Bransfield's first trip, yes.
How was she?
It had its troubles. I think it was built, it was completed late, and they virtually, I think, did the sea trials and then loaded it up and came south. And it had its a brand new ship. It obviously had its problems.
Such as?
I think it was. I think it had some stability problems with it. I think in a rough sea it could. So the rumour went that once it went over and didn't quite come back very quickly. It just came back extremely slowly, and I think a lot of people were a bit apprehensive. but I guess they did something about it, reballasted it or something. I don't know. But there were problems because we were not allowed up to go above our deck. You know, if you go up those stairs, you're in deep trouble.
Because of the...
No, not because of stability. I think they had all their problems to sort out with a new ship, and they didn't want us up there poking asking silly questions. Yeah. Hey, mister, why do you do that? sod off.
Well, we'll brought you back to the UK now, and we know that you went south again, but we'll perhaps talk about that after a break.
Yeah, sure.